State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Excuse me, a little bit late. We had a very important Veterans Caucus this morning. Welcome, everybody. I'm going to take the roll call of the House State Affairs Committee, then I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Dyson, or what's his name over there? And Representative Ising is, in fact, excused, and Representative Millet has been excused. She has a dental appointment, and I'm glad she has it, and not me. Please call the roll for the House State Affairs Committee.
Representative Keller.
Here.
Representative Millet, absent. Representative Kreis Tompkins.
Here.
Representative Gaddis.
Here.
Representative Hughes.
Here.
Representative Isaacson.
Excused.
Chair Lynn.
Here, and Representative Millet is excused. Thank you very much. Give the gavel to my friend, colleague, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank
Chair
you.
Chair of the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Yeah, and Senate members present are Senator Geisel, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Dyson. Senator Stedman is choosing to not join us. Who else we
have? Coghill.
And Senator Coghill is excused. He's at home. So, we are joining here for a state joint state affairs meetings, and Commissioner Holbert is going to be making the lead-off presentations. She's the head of the Department of Administration, and please come forward and bring any of your hired hands you want with you.
I'm going to be joined, I think, here by Deputy Commissioner Barnhill.
Yeah, so identify yourself for the record, and
For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and with me I have Deputy Commissioner Mike Barnhill. A little bit later, we will ask Emily Cotter to come up and join us. She is our Strategic Health Initiatives Coordinator.
All right, please proceed.
So thank you so much for having us here today and for meeting together so we could do a joint presentation. There's been a lot of interest in healthcare and in our employee health plan as we've done overviews of the department and talked about our responsibilities with respect to employee healthcare. So this presentation is a little bit of a deeper dive into our health plan. And along with talking about our health plan specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about national trends in terms of healthcare costs, about state trends in terms of healthcare costs. We're going to also talk about some options that we're looking at for how we could improve our healthcare plan to hopefully get better value. And by value, and we'll probably use that word a few times through the presentation, by value, we're talking about high quality care at a reasonable cost. So we are at a point in our plan where we need to look at whether or not it's time to make some changes. And we need to begin conversations about what those changes might look like. So that's how we'll conclude the presentation, is talking about some of those options, recognizing that we're probably not going to be making any plan changes or significant plan changes this year. But I believe it's time to start the conversation about what our plan might look like in the future. So we all know that healthcare costs continue to rise at an unacceptably high rate. And this graph just demonstrates in dollar terms our national health expenditures per capita. And you can see that in a decade they've almost doubled. And when you look at 1960, 1970, 1980, 1990, all the way through 2010, you can tell that curve is alarmingly steep. And that, in essence, is not a surprise to any of us. It's part of the problem that we have with healthcare costs in our country.
Excuse me. Are these dollars of the day, or is inflation taken into that?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, these would be nominal dollars of the day.
Okay. So, and just roughly, what has been inflation, if you had an aggregate inflation rate over that, looks like 50 years?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what the rate of inflation has been over that time period, but I think this next slide gives you an idea of another important variable that's not inflation, but GDP. And we could certainly find the rate of inflation and compare it to.
Yes.
Go back. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Quick question. You indicated in your opening that we won't make changes this year, but you wanted to open up the discussion. Is it safe to say because you have contracts that don't allow you to open it up this year?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, that's part of the reason. Part of the reason is we're not prepared at this time in the year to do that. Right now, we are in the midst of a request for proposals for a third-party administrator, pharmacy benefit manager, healthcare management vendor, and dental network. It is a massive RFP. It's one of the largest service contracts that the state has. And until we can get through that RFP process, we're just not operationally in a place where we can do the due diligence necessary to implement
changes.
Okay, that
changes. Makes sense. I was just wondering why.
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Please proceed.
So the next slide compares the rate of growth of health spending and GDP per capita. And I think this is really the essence of the problem with health care. The problem is not that costs have gone up as much as it is that costs are rising at a level that is much greater than GDP, which means that health care is consuming a larger and larger part of our economic pie. That's the real issue we need to address. We need to get health care cost inflation down to the rate of inflation, or at least the rate of GDP growth, so that healthcare is not consuming more and more of our national resources. Moving down a level from the national perspective to the state perspective, you can see the estimated healthcare expenditures in Alaska. This is from an Institute of Social and Economic Research study in 2011. So in 2010, we were at about $7.5 billion in healthcare spending. That equates to a half the wellhead value of oil produced in Alaska in 2010 and half of Alaska wages in 2010. So as you can see, for the state of Alaska, healthcare is consuming a larger and larger part of our economic pie, and therein lies part of our dilemma. So moving now one level down, we've talked about national healthcare experience, the state of Alaska healthcare experience. Now we're going to talk about the state of Alaska's experience as an entity. So this chart shows you the different things that we spend, or different areas in which we have healthcare costs. So moving down this list, we have the Alaska Care Health Plan, which is the line at the bottom. That's the plan that covers about a little more than a third of our employees, and we'll talk about how the other employees get health insurance. Then we have the Retiree Health Plan, PERS, TERS, and JERS. They're separate on here, but combined, they're a pretty large healthcare expenditure. Medicaid, obviously, is the elephant in the room. They are the lion's share of our healthcare spending. Although these are just, these Medicaid dollars are all Medicaid services. Medicaid provides a lot of services that aren't necessarily what we would consider traditional healthcare. Corrections, we spend money on inmate healthcare. And we also spend money on workers' compensation. And that expense is also managed through our department. And that has been although it's a very small slice, it's been a growing expenditure.
Excuse me. It would help me if you'd slow down a little bit. I know you know this material very well, but for my sake, please slow down a little bit. What's JRS?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. JRS is JRS, the Judicial Retirement System. So that's the retirement system for our judges.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And most of us don't speak an acronym well, so make a little effort to define the new ones, please.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you for the reminder, and I will do my best to do that. We have in our department a list of about 4 pages worth of acronym translations, and I will work to not use that list.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similar question to what Senator Dyson asked on. I assume these are fixed dollars at some year. But then also, on the PERS cost, is that predominantly Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3? And then can we expect that to drop off as people age and retire out?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, since we have closed pension systems at some point in the future, yes, those costs will tail off. And I'm going to let Mr. Barnhill speak to that a little bit more. But it's not going to be for some time, because we are on the crest of a large increase in the number of retirees, which is going to drive our costs higher for the foreseeable future.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the costs aren't expected in the retirement plan to tail off until the peak in 2046.
Please.
Yeah, and I would just add, Mr. Chair, I'd love to see that sort of bell curve that you have plotted out over the next, I'm sure you have it somewhere.
We do.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's in this one, but we can actually pull it up.
And I would guess that your chart two here, that inflation is at least 50%, and I'll bet it's closer to 100% from in the last 50 years. And but that really doesn't affect much the last 10 years with what you're concentrating on. But my guess is the jump here in the decades there would be less if they were constant dollars. Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, back on the previous slide, whether you have the information as far as the number of participants in each of those categories and the cost per participant and how it compares to those.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I'm certain we could gather that information. One of the challenges is defining at what point you measure participation. And so we could get that information. It may not be completely consistent, although it would be directionally correct. For our retirement systems, often we will get participation numbers at a point in time when it's probably more accurate to get an average across years, but all the data is not collected in exactly the same way.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So this next chart talks about spending and what the state of Alaska is contributing through the monthly benefit credit to active employee health plans. Now, I think one of the significant parts of this slide is it is on the right, it shows you where those contributions are going. So the state of Alaska, on behalf of every employee, pays a benefit credit every month. That benefit credit, though, goes to different places for different groups of employees. So the first item on that list to the right is AlaskaCare, the employee health plan that legislators are a part of, our exempt and partially exempt employees are a part of, and several of our unions are part of. And I'll show you a list of those unions on the next page. The second on the list is the ASEA Health Trust. That is the health trust, the Alaska State Employees Association Health Trust. That is the health trust for the members of our general government unit. That bargaining unit is the largest bargaining unit that we have in state government, over 8,000 employees. And so that's why when you look at how big our AlaskaCare plan is, it's only about two-thirds of our employees because that general government unit is so large. Then the next one is the Labor Trades and Crafts Health Trust. That's another bargaining unit health trust. The Public Safety Employees Association has third-party insurance, but again, we still pay on behalf of those employees. We do not insure those employees ourselves.
Excuse me. Explain a little bit to me or us the LTC, the labor.
Mr. Chairman, Labor Trades and Crafts is one of our local 51 is a bargaining unit, and they have a health trust. So just like we contribute to the Alaska State Employees Association Health Trust, we contribute to the Labor Trades and Crafts Health Trust.
And is that several bargaining units in it?
Mr. Chairman, it's one. There are several bargaining units in the health trust, yes. It's not just a health trust for those employees. It's a union health trust that has many, many different participants.
Yeah. Can you run through a short list at least?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know who the other participants are in the LTC health trust.
But would it be like carpenters, plumbers?
Again, I don't know specifically, but I'm sure they'd be willing to provide us with a list of members of the health,
thank you.
Their health
please
trust.
Continue.
The next item down is the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Health Trust. This is one of our Marine unions. They are fairly small in terms of the number of employees. So this, again, is another health trust that has many, many members, not just our employees. And then the last one, and I apologize, I don't know the first acronym. The second acronym is the Teachers. Actually, I'm not even going to try that acronym. It's the Mount Edgecombe Teachers. So Mount Edgecombe Teachers were part of the NEA Health Trust, and then they terminated with NEA and came back to be to AlaskaCare.
And excuse me, back to the PSE, the public safety folks, is that more than just the troopers?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. There are public safety employees in many different jurisdictions that are pooled together in this plan, but the other health trusts are self-insured union health trust plans. The PSEA plan, they actually go out and purchase third-party insurance. So it's a little bit of a different structure, but from the state's perspective, we're still just writing the check. We're not managing the care or the coverage.
Thank you.
So again, you can look at the red bars on this slide and see that in the course of a decade, we've gone from just under $100 million in spending to over $250 million in spending for these populations of employees. So a significant growth, certainly, and one that we're very cognizant of and working to contain.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, do you have anything that shows the employee contributions that would compare the state contributions to the employee contributions for those years?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, on later slides, we have information about employee contributions. Are you asking about the Union Health Trust contributions or just for our Alaska Care Plan?
For all of them, just something that would compare, because we can see the rate of growth. The rate of growth there, and I'm just wondering if the employee contributions have been similar.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we don't have complete visibility on the Union Health Trust, although we know what a lot of their employee contributions are. I can tell you for Alaska Care, we fund the basic premium for the economy plan and at 100%, and that hasn't changed. So the on some future slides, we'll show you the breakdown between what the portion the state pays and the portion that employees pay for our Alaska Care Plan. Like I said, for the plans that we don't manage, we have a lot less visibility.
Yep. Representative Gaddis.
And it sounds like that you're going to follow up on some of the questions I had, but one of them for the plans that you don't manage, do you have in later slides at least how much you pay per person?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, we pay the same amount for all of these plans per person with the exception of the Alaska State Employees Association plan. We pay a higher amount in that plan, but that was negotiated in a contract, at least one contract to go, if not more.
And so, is the differential listed? Will we get to that?
Through the chair, Representative Gaddis, we'll get to the premium contribution. I didn't list the ASC contribution separately, except to note that it is a little bit higher. It equates to about $2.5 million more for that group, but that group again is a fairly large group.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So this slide demonstrates the number of employees that we have in our Alaska Care Health Plan and the groups of employees in that plan. And we already talked a little bit about the bars on the chart on the right, which shows the Union Health Trusts and which employees are in Union Health Trusts. So on the left side, I'll just quickly run through this list. We have AVTEC, the Alaska Vocational Technical. I'm going to butcher that acronym as well. My apologies. That's the Seward AVTEC. Those are the Seward AVTEC employees. The confidential employees, those represent primarily our human resources employees. They have a separate bargaining unit. Correctional officers, marine engineers on the ferry system, the Mount Edgecombe teachers, the supervisory union, which is our second largest bargaining unit, the Inland Boatmen's Union, which is another marine union, and then all of our exempt and partially exempt employees. So those are essentially the employees that we're covering within the Alaska Care Plan.
Excuse me, I personally would enjoy some more information about all the maritime people. I think there's five of them here. Size, how much, so on.
We can certainly provide that. So now we're going to get to, I think, Representative Gaddis's question and other questions about what's the benefit credit. So I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Barnhill here for some time.
Good morning. Mike Barnhill, Department of Administration, Deputy Commissioner. The next few slides talk about the specifics regarding the cost structure of our Alaska Care Health Plan and some of the coverage provisions at a relatively high level. You folks seem to have a lot of really great questions on detail, so I've pulled up some spreadsheets on historical data, and I can attempt to answer hopefully most of your questions. So benefit credit. So this is often referred to as the health insurance credit that we pay, the state of Alaska pays on behalf of every single active employee, roughly 17,000 employees in the state of Alaska. And as the commissioner just indicated, that benefit credit, it's a monthly benefit credit that the state pays, has been roughly the same between bargaining units, partially exempt and exempt employees, and What am I missing? Bargaining units and, okay. So, okay, benefit credit. This graph shows the fairly dramatic increase over just over a decade of $512 a month back in FY01 to $1,250 a month in FY12. For FY14, we've proposed in the governor's budget a benefit credit of $1,389. So, you know, we're closing in on tripling the amount that the state pays on behalf of all state employees on a monthly basis in, you know, 14 years, 15 years. With respect to the Alaska State Employees Association Health Trust, I believe the surplus that we pay is approximately $27 per month in addition. There has been some variance over time, particularly in the early part of this time period, 2001, 2002, where there was some deviation amongst bargaining units from what the state pays the partially exempt and exempt folks. But more recently, there's been a trend to a consolidated uniform amount. We have negotiated this with the bargaining units, and the typical negotiation is that the benefit credit will equate to the monthly premium of our economy level plan option in Alaska Care. And we'll get to a slide in just a moment, but there are three plan options in Alaska Care: economy, standard, and premium. So the benefit credit equates to the economy level plus the preventive dental. And there are three levels of dental: preventive, standard, and premium.
Excuse me, Representative Hughes has a question.
You've said that the benefit credit has tripled in the last 15 years. How does that compare to other states? Are we more generous? Have we been?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. It hasn't quite tripled. It's on its way to tripling, but it hasn't quite tripled. How does it compare to other states? I guess there's two ways of taking this. The state of Alaska tends to be among the most generous of states in providing a payment to employees for health insurance. My understanding is right now we're one of a handful of states that pays all of the base level health insurance, which is functionally what the benefit credit does for the economy plan. If you elect into the economy plan as an employee, you pay nothing for that insurance.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Sure. Let's see, anything else to say here? No. This just shows the trend over time. And one thing to note, and we see this in the retirement spend as well, is this characteristic of health cost trends where they flatline for a period of 3 years, then there's a sharp uptick, and then another flat line, and then a sharp uptick. So you can see a flat line in the benefit credit from 97 to 99, a three-year uptick, and then another flat line. So it's just this alternating plateaus and sharp upticks. Right now, in the 12, 13, 14 time period, we're in a plateau. And that's informed a lot of our internal discussion about managing the health plan, is that we believe we have an opportunity at this point to become more proactive in how we manage the plan, take advantage of the plateau, and hopefully be able to mitigate somewhat the next time there's a sharp uptick. Okay, Alaska Care. Again, Alaska Care is just the plan that covers partially exempt, exempt employees, the legislature, the court system, the supervisory union bargaining unit, the correctional officers, Alaska correctional officers, and CEA.
There's a few other small bargaining units.
And that's about 6,400 employees Total population, employee population of the state is around 17,000. So it's a fraction. It's certainly not the majority. We're self-insured. Alaska Care became self-insured about 12 years ago. It was fully insured up until that point in time. Alaska statute conferred upon the Department of Administration the authorization to form a self-insurance pool. Typically, it's thought that self-insurance pools are cheaper to administer because you're not paying the profit margin of an insurance company. So we use a third-party administrator to process claims. That third-party administrator is an entity called HealthSmart. This entity became our third-party administrator at the beginning of last year when the entity that we had selected in the last procurement cycle for the third-party administrator, Wells Fargo, their claims processing unit was acquired by HealthSmart. We're presently in a procurement process, and that procurement process for a third-party administrator we expect will be completed later this spring.
Excuse me. How do you evaluate those folks, the different administrator groups?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question, and we continue to focus a fair amount of time and effort in how we properly evaluate and manage all of our vendors for Alaska Care. There's a variety of ways. The first way that happens on a quarterly basis is that the third-party administrator and other vendors, including the pharmacy benefit manager, the vision provider, there's a data integrator called Verisk. They produce a quarterly report, which we review, and we look at the statistics of what's going on in the plan. But there are also other things that we look at fairly closely, and that's the number of complaints that we hear about how claims are being administered, how those complaints are being resolved, whether we believe that the complaints are being resolved appropriately. And there's been a fair amount of time and effort focused on that over the past year. As a product, let me back up. Typically, when a contract for third-party administrator is issued, it's issued for a three-year term with 2 1-year extensions. And that's the case with Wells Fargo. We exercised the first 1-year extension. We're in that now. We've declined to exercise the second 1-year extension. Instead, we opted to go out for another procurement cycle. The reason we did that was twofold. Number one, we didn't select HealthSmart in the procurement process. They acquired the entity that we selected. And for that reason, since they did not actually participate in the procurement process, we thought that it was prudent to go back out to the market and give everybody an equal chance to bid on this contract.
Excuse me. The real issue is, I was trying to ask about, is how will you evaluate those proposals?
Oh, the proposals. Okay, sorry, I misunderstood your question. The request for proposals is quite a magnificent document. It's about that tall. And it has extensive questions covering every single aspect of their claims processing units, who they are, what they do, how they do it, how fast they do it, how they monitor for quality control, what are they doing in terms of innovation. So we're expecting proposals I believe are due on February 8th. There may have been a recent extension to that. But we're expecting some fairly large proposals to be submitted. They will be evaluated by a proposal evaluation committee that consists of four individuals, myself being one. And we will scrutinize them.
Okay. It's still missing what I'm after. I hear you saying if they answer all the questions right and so on and so forth, but do you look at their track record doing this in other jurisdictions?
Absolutely. Everything. We'll be looking at everything. These proposals, the request for proposals is incredibly comprehensive,
yep.
And we'd be happy to share it, but every single thing about them we'll be looking at.
So nationally, and I've certainly seen it here in our state, we are paying for services that didn't need to be done and probably paying more on some of them. And is there a way to analyze both our present provider and the ones we're considering?
In terms of, Mr. Chair, in terms of whether they're paying too much or approving care that's not necessary, you know, those are all very difficult and complex questions that we are very concerned about. There's no easy way to evaluate whether care is being paid for that's not necessary. We have access to our data at a fairly granular level. We can see what procedures are being done, when they're being done, how much they cost. We do get advice from and information from our providers about where there are areas that we can focus on and try and become more proactive in the management of those to make sure that the care being provided is appropriate and that the pay that we make to the providers is appropriate. But again, it's you're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of claims.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The health care benefits that employees under collective bargaining receive, is that, that's negotiated? That's part of the collective bargaining agreement?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the only thing that's negotiated is the dollar amount of the benefit credit. The care that the Union Health Trust provide, the coverage that the Union Health Trust provide, is entirely within their control.
So just so I can just have a few questions. So basically, the employees come in, they say, this is the amount we need, and then they manage the health trust. Is that how it works?
Through the chair, roughly that's accurate. I hesitate a bit because each health trust has a board of trustees. They manage the health trust, not the employees themselves.
How long are the...
Follow-up?
Yeah, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long are the terms of the contract usually?
Collective bargaining, through
right.
the chair.
So ASCA, you should all the unions. Is there typically 2, 3, 4 year terms?
Three year terms typically through the chair.
So your administration negotiated these amounts just a couple years ago. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I believe that we're now in our first cycle, yes, of having negotiated all the contracts. But I would note that when you have an established pattern of the state has done X for forever or for a very long time, then to change that dynamic in bargaining is very difficult. And right now, we're not necessarily proposing significant changes in the way that the state has handled health care through bargaining, but we are looking at it. And in the future, we might propose changes, just as we could with any other negotiated item in a contract cycle.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to note one thing regarding the TPA, the third-party administrator contract, and that is that a significant portion of the scoring for that request for proposals is on the network, because network brings such a significant value in terms of savings to the state. And we don't have the capacity right now, although we've looked at in the future, perhaps developing and negotiating our own network. But we're not prepared to do that yet, so our network we acquire through this process.
Excuse me. And does network mean electronic communication?
Mr. Chairman, network is the negotiated discounts that we have with providers. So we don't go out and negotiate ourselves, with the exception, I think, of in the past, the Anchorage Hospital agreement. But overall, we don't go out and negotiate with providers to see if they will sign contracts with us and be in our network. We've acquired that network through this third-party administrator process. We've looked at whether or not it might make sense for the state as an enterprise to go out and develop our own network, but that would require a lot of staff and resources that we just don't have the capacity to provide right now.
So I would have never guessed that that's what the word network means. You know, so just consider that when you're trying. You can never underestimate how informed we are. Representative Hughes.
In that scoring process, in the RFP process, is there weight given to whether within that network it's in-state or out-of-state? Because I understand that certain medical provisions can be provided less expensively outside the state. So how is that weighing into the process?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, yes, there's weight given to the discounts that the providers in the network can provide to the plan. And that's actually quite a big chunk of the score. So what happened, if you, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can go through some of the details.
No, I think you're actually missing the questions being asked at Representative Hughes.
Yeah, well, one of the things I'm wondering is whether there's preference given to in-state providers, or you're looking solely at the cost. And then how you score it.
Okay. I may have missed it in part, Mr. Chair. Thank you. There is a preference, an Alaska bidder's preference, that's conferred by the procurement code. It's a 10%. So any Alaska bidder that qualifies will get 10% added to their score. So that's if you're a vendor that is doing business within the state of Alaska, then you will get 10% added to your score automatically. Now, with respect to providers and how much they charge within a provider network, what happens, and I apologize if this is too much detail, is we have sent each of the vendors who wish to bid on this proposal a claims file of 12 months of claims. These are real claims that the Alaska Care Program experienced. And we're asking them to reprice them. Just tell us how much your network would have charged had you processed these claims. Then that body of data goes to the actuary, and they'll spit out a number, and they'll say, this network was the cheapest over the last 12 months, this was the second cheapest, this was the third cheapest, and then the score for network, what we call network, the provider network, will be computed as a result of how those claims actually priced.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I'm not, when I'm talking about preference for in-state, I'm not talking about the vendor, the third-party administrator that's submitting the RFP. I'm talking about preference for the healthcare providers that are in-state versus out-of-state, that when you're looking at the network.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we have employees who obviously live and work in Alaska. We have retirees who live and work out of state. So when we're evaluating a network and we're looking at that, we need to provide the best possible cost for that care wherever that employee lives. So through the process of a network, we're not necessarily looking at comparing one market to another market. We're looking at what's the best price we can get in Anchorage, or the best price we can get in Seattle. We're not looking at whether Anchorage or Seattle offer a better value. What we are going to be looking for, though, is our third-party administrator to bring us some innovative ideas. They may bring us a Centers of Excellence network. I don't know. We'll wait and see when the proposals come in. But a Centers of Excellence network might provide us with a very low-cost, high-quality network of large medical centers for certain specialty procedures like cardiac or orthopedics. So we're looking for innovation, but we're not, through this RFP process, trying to make a decision about whether care is going to be provided in one city over another city, or which city is going to be the cheapest care. We're just trying to find overall what is the best, what network provides us the best value in any location where our members might live, which includes the lower 48, because we have so many retirees that live in the lower 48.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just clear up something for me? My understanding is most of the employees that work for the state are members of a union, and they go through their own health trust. So you give them a flat amount, and then you tell the union to go manage that trust, and they do that. So who's on the self-insured plan? That's what I'm having a hard time. Is that the retirees?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is the list right here of who's in that self-insured plan. So it is a number of bargaining units, but it is also our exempt and partially exempt employees.
So it's the 6,400 people.
That list encompasses the the 6,400 people.
Commissioner, a great interest of mine has been medical fraud. And my understanding is, obviously, the major portion of that is fraud by providers. And it has been estimated out of the, 1.4, 1.6 billion that we spend Medicaid? They're pretty close.
Mr. Chair, I believe so, but I will not bank on it.
I think 1. I'm in the ballpark. And it's been estimated by people who should know that the fraud in our state is somewhere between 200 and 400 million. And when you evaluate your administrators, do you evaluate them on the basis of their capacity, proven capacity, to spot fraud?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall seeing the word fraud in the request for proposals. We can go back and look and see whether it was singled out explicitly. What I can tell you is that we do evaluate based on the ability to appropriately process claims. And so that's going to encompass not only fraud, but a process, provision of care that falls short of fraud, but may fall into the medically unnecessary category, may fall into a gray category, may fall into a medically necessary category, but wasn't covered in the initial go-around. So there's a variety of things that we look at. What we want to make sure is that the claims are processed accurately as soon as possible.
Yeah, Department of Health has a whole section, you know, trying to work on that, and so does the Department of Law.
And we definitely appreciate that, and that's something that we'll take back and look at. I will say my sense is that if there's a tendency towards error on the part of the current claims administrator, it is that they're too conservative, potentially, in how they grant claims. And I say that because we get a fair amount of noise from folks who've had a claim denied or reduced for some reason, and they believe it was done inappropriately.
I'm shocked that you never have anybody complaining about getting too much.
I think it's happened once.
I'm sorry, please continue.
Okay. All right, so we've talked a bit about the population. We've got 6,400 covered employees. They have 10,000 dependents. Covered lives is 16,400, roughly. Alaska Care has three plan options. We've discussed the economy plan for an additional amount that the employee pays as a deduction from their paycheck. They can elect the standard plan, which has somewhat better coverage provisions and cost reimbursement provisions, or the premium plan, which is even more expensive. And then there's a hybrid, which isn't identified here, which is a premium employee standard family. We also have dental coverage. By statute, we require employees to elect dental coverage. We have three levels there, the preventive, standard, and premium, which the latter one, I believe, covers orthodontia. And then also elective, we have vision coverage, standard, and managed care. Anything that is above the economy medical, preventive dental, the employee pays through a payroll deduction. Here's the cost structure of our plan. By cost structure, I'm talking about what the deductibles, the coinsurance amounts, and the annual out-of-pocket maxes are. And you can see that the deductibles are higher in the cheaper plan, lower in the more expensive plans. That makes sense. The coinsurance amounts, that is the amount that the plan will reimburse the employee. Lower 70% coinsurance in the economy plan, 80 in the standard, 90 in the premium. And then the out-of-pocket maxes also reflect the relative cost of the plan, higher out-of-pocket max in the economy plan, $2,000 per person, $1,000 in the standard, $300 in the premium. This plan is subject to the Affordable Care Act. Therefore, it has no, it's grandfathered. I'm sorry. Thank you. But we do comply with that provision of the Affordable Care Act, which requires no lifetime maximums. And then we have ER copay of $100 for non-emergent use. Recently, we've added coverage of preventive care at 100%, and the purpose of that was to incent folks to get preventive care, to take better care of themselves, to take personal responsibility for their health. And that's something we're monitoring. It's an enhancement we added in hopes that we could take advantage of this plateauing of costs right now and see if we can't mitigate the next sharp uptick through initiatives like this. And then we also, consistent with the Affordable Care Act and this plan, cover children up to age 26. Here are the premiums for FY13. In the economy plan, you can see that the monthly premium for the plan is $1,330. That equates to the benefit credit for medical of $1,330. And then the premium amounts go up based on the tier of the plan. And those amounts, the differential, the employee pays. The employee pays $117 if they elect the standard plan. That's a monthly payroll deduction. $615 if they elect premium for the employee and the family. $327 if they elect that hybrid, the premium employee standard family. Earlier I referenced that the state has been quite generous in its provision of this benefit credit. We are one of a handful of states that covers 100% of the premium for the lowest cost family insurance policy. One thing that we're struggling with now that is a bit of a conundrum, quite frankly, and this is a problem we believe has been going on for quite some time, is that the premiums don't actually accurately reflect the costs of those plans. And what's happened over time, at one point in time, those premiums probably were set so that the economy monthly premium was roughly about the same of what the costs were in the economy plan. But over time, the utilization in each of those plans has changed, and we now have pretty high utilization in the most expensive plan, premium plan. And so the costs are actually considerably higher than those monthly costs in the premium plan. And in the economy plan, the costs are actually considerably lower. And so what's happening functionally is over time we've allowed a subsidy to creep in that runs from the economy plan participants, the state that's paying for that, to the premium plan participants. And the amount of that subsidy this year is roughly about $900 per month. Unraveling that is, we've been scratching at this with the actuaries. There's no easy way of doing this. But it's something that we're paying attention to. It's something that we've started the discussion with our stakeholders. And I should mention, we meet with our stakeholders on a quarterly basis. This is a product of a term in our collective bargaining agreement with the supervisory union and the collective, the correctional officers. It's called the Health Benefits Evaluation Committee. And we meet with them on a quarterly basis to go over the medical reports that are provided by the our vendors, to talk about coverage, to talk about premiums. And our stakeholders are aware of this subsidy. They've been aware of it, I think, longer than I have. But we know over time, as that subsidy grows larger, it just becomes increasingly unfair, I think, to the economy level and standard level participants to be subsidizing care to the premium level participants at that level.
Excuse me, Representative Keller has a question.
The thought that comes to my mind, as the ban on consideration of pre-existing conditions has come into being, I would think that the premium plan would represent people that are need medical, higher cost of medical care. So it has to do with the redefinition of what insurance is fundamentally, and I'm assuming that your examination of that will give us some insight into that. But I would, you know, my guess is that, just not knowing, this is just a knee-jerk, is that the premium plan would include people that have very expensive conditions because they can't, that's, you know, that whole dynamic.
Through the chair, I think your assumption that the premium plan includes people with expensive conditions is probably correct. It may include people that may not have expensive conditions, but for whatever reason utilize care at a higher rate. These are difficult questions of fairness and subsidy and insurance and how you properly manage a plan, and I don't have a solution for the committee today except to just identify it and say that it's something that we probably should address over time, so that, and we asked our actuary, by the way, we said, does this level of subsidy something you see elsewhere? And they said, absolutely not. This is outside of the norm. And the reason I think why it crept in is because whenever we increase the premium amount for the plans on an annual basis, the factor we use to increase that is exactly the same for each plan. So this year, for FY14, we're proposing to increase the premiums by 4.4% for each level. But if the utilization of care in each level is not increased by 4.4%, for instance, in the economy plan, it may have declined by 10%. In the standard plan, it may have been flat, and in the premium plan, it may have increased by 20%. By increasing everybody by 4%, you're just allowing that subsidy spread to increase over time, and that's what's happened.
I personally appreciate the frankness you have about discussing these issues that you're addressing. That certainly builds credibility. Senator Welikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume those different medical premiums are things that you have previously negotiated at the bargaining table and you could renegotiate at the bargaining table, or is that not?
Through the chair, Senator Welikowski, we only negotiate the contribution for the Union Health Trust, and for the other plans, we simply say in the contract that we will pay the economy plan premium. And that's not the exact language. But essentially, we don't negotiate the premium plan or the standard plan. We just negotiate that we'll cover the benefit credit for the economy plan, preventive dental. So coverage is not negotiated. And really, the bulk of and the fact that we have several plans is not negotiated. We just negotiate that the economy plan.
You just negotiate that. Yeah. You just negotiate one number, and then the union, at least through their trust portion, goes ahead and does what they want with the remaining plan.
Through the chair, Senator Welikowski, for the Union Health Trust, yes, their coverage looks very different than ours. And quite frankly, that's kind of problematic because we're one employer and we have employees that move from being in a non-supervisory position to being in a supervisory position, and all of a sudden their health plan changes. And sometimes their contribution goes up because, at least in the case from moving to a GGU to a supervisory, the ASCA Health Trust has an employee-only plan. We don't. And so we've begun meeting with the Union Health Trust on a more regular basis, which I think has been a positive step, because while we're never going to have complete plan alignment, at least it's enabled us to look at our plans and say, wow, we have a real misalignment here between what your plan covers and what our plan covers. Maybe we need to look at that. So I think, in response to your question, yes, the plans look very different, and that can be difficult for employees. But we're working, I think, in a cooperative way to try to address those areas where there are really large outliers.
Senator, thank you. And so 2 points. One point is, are they doing a better job managing health funds, or is the state doing a better job? That's point one. But point two is, just on your bullet there about Alaska being one of only four states to cover 100% of the premium, I think the way collective bargaining agreements work is you sort of take a pool and you look at, well, wages and health care benefits and pensions and maybe other fringe benefits, and then you come up with a total number, and then you employees say, well, we would like a little more in health care. And so you could turn that around and say, well, Alaska's the only state in the country that doesn't offer a defined benefit plan for its employees. So maybe we're a little higher on the health care, but on pensions, we're the worst in the nation with no Social Security benefits for public employees.
And through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I completely disagree with your assessment, but I don't really think that now is the time to get into the defined benefit pension issue, although we're certainly happy in a different venue to do that. We're not trying to make a value judgment here. We're just trying to give you an assessment of what our plan is and where that plan fits within national norms.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, I actually like to field Senator Wilkowski's question about who does it better. And he may be surprised by this answer. You know, I think the ACA Health Trust does a great job of managing health care. And that may sound counterintuitive. Our concern really comes down to what's the best way of managing the whole. And when we fragment our employee population like this, we lose the benefit of scale. And one of the most important things in managing risk is the size of your pool. We've met with the ASCE Health Trust a number of times, and I've been very impressed with their wisdom, with the innovation that they've brought to this, their forward thinking. And quite frankly, I think we've learned from that. And I'm glad that they're doing that. But at the end of the day, if we can all do those things in the single pool, my guess is it would be more cost effective. I don't expect you to agree with that latter statement. But I will give credit where credit is due.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, just so I understand correctly, that $900 subsidizing by the economy to the premium, so that means that the premium for the economy could really be about $400, and the premium for the premium plan would be around $2,800, $2,900. Is that correct? And the reason we haven't increased that $615 for those that are participating in the premium plan is because there would be an outcry that it would be too much. You had said that you adjust them, I think, what, 4.4% across the board, and I'm just wondering why you haven't adjusted that amount that those choosing the premium plan are paying in out of pocket.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the latter part of your statement was correct. There would be an outcry if we made an adjustment to correspond to experience. The former part of your statement was not quite correct because there isn't a one-for-one. For FY14, if we did a one-for-one, the premium plan amount would go up to somewhere around $2,800 a month. The standard plan would go up to $1,400 to $1,600 a month. The economy plan would go down to somewhere in the range of, I think it was $800 a month. That would create dislocation. We're not proposing to do that. We're just noting that that's what the relative costs of the plan are, and how you unravel that, I don't have an answer for you.
Mr. Chairman, I think the approach that we are investigating and looking at taking to address these subsidizations, because I think at some level they do need to be addressed. Because even though the state pays 100% of the economy plan premium, people are paying more out of pocket for their care because of those coverage provisions. So you do essentially have the subsidization where the people who are electing the lowest cost plan from a premium standpoint are subsidizing through their own dollars the higher level plan. So I think we kind of have a moral obligation to address this in some way, recognizing that it's very complex and there are consequences, and we have to be sure that there aren't unintended consequences of addressing it. But I think looking at an incremental approach where we are incrementally adjusting premiums so that we're not creating significant dislocation between the plans is the approach that we're proposing. We don't have any specifics on what that would look like yet, but at some point, every year we don't do something creates a larger and larger subsidization, which is not ultimately a good way to manage these plans.
Well, I appreciate that because I do think it needs to be more fair. Thank you.
Do you know, is there a correlation between which program plan a person or family takes and their utilization of medical services?
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to do some due diligence in diving into the premium plan and perhaps a lesser extent to the standard plan to understand that dynamic. Because to Representative Keller's earlier point, it is likely that people are selecting the premium plan because they have very high costs. They're sick. They know they're going to have high costs. It is also likely, though, that because if you look at the out-of-pocket experience in that plan, your $300 out-of-pocket max is not very high. So beyond that, care becomes free to the employee. And so there is likely much higher utilization than is perhaps necessary in that plan as well. We just don't know how much of the plan cost is related to disease profile and how much is related to utilization.
I think you're right that that would be a valuable analysis. And I suspect, as we talked about, as you move more towards preventative stuff and encouraging that, that will impact the those figures in the out years. Please continue.
And Mr. Chair, there's one more point I want to make on this discussion, which I've neglected to raise, and that there's two parties to any medical transaction. That's the patient and the provider. And the providers in Alaska are rational participants in the marketplace. And when there is money that flows into the marketplace that essentially makes care free, those participants will act rationally. And one way they act rationally is to adjust their pricing structure to take up the money that's in the marketplace. And I think that's one thing, quite frankly, that does drive price increases in the marketplace, is the availability of money that essentially feels free to the patient. And I think you'll see that wherever you see government subsidies flow into a marketplace, marketplace participants act rationally and increase their cost structure. You see that in university education. You see that in medical care throughout this country. And so I think it's unfair to focus the discussion primarily on patient utilization. That's a part of it. But I think also another part of it is just the amount that government subsidization influences market participation.
And that really relates to my earlier question about unnecessary treatment and so on. At some point here in the discussion, or perhaps the next one we have, I'd like you to tell us the details about what you call the network, which basically is the provider discounts. You go to a provider and say, I'm bringing 6,000 employees to you, I want a volume discount here. And probably your previous life would give you some experience with that. But I'd like to know what's the discount we get from the different kinds of providers that you call the network.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to come back if you'd like us back in front of you at a later time or provide you a written response on that. I can tell you that we, just overall, as a big picture look at it, we tend to have preferred providers, providers within the network, at the primary care level. We tend to have preferred providers in communities where there is hospital competition. Where there is no hospital competition, we don't always have, the hospital doesn't always join the network. And we have a significant issue with our specialists. We tend to not have very many specialists in network because generally, as a group, specialists in Alaska tend not to join networks, which of course makes our costs for those services much higher. But we can provide much more detail than that.
Yeah, and back to Representative Hughes's earlier question, you know, pharmacists have claimed that they're getting the short end of the stick because you all are going to outside providers, you know, big ones, and I'm sure there's a volume advantage there. And all of us want industry and people in the state to go to work, and I'd be interested in how much you saved by going out of state to get those providers, even with local providers getting the 10% credit in a sense. But we can do that offline. And both the questions I just asked, I'd appreciate you sending the information to Representative Lynn and myself, and we'll distribute it to committee members and make a decision about whether we want you to come back and talk about it. Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, just to be clear, Deputy Commissioner Barnhill, you mentioned the market response. You know, we have rational providers, and just maybe I didn't catch this, but since you instituted the free coverage for preventive care. Have we specifically seen that they are now charging more for those preventive procedures?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that's something we're actually watching for. It's too soon. We just turned it on in this fiscal year. But that, in our discussions, was a concern. Would we be taken advantage of? And is the everything has a, you know, a cost-benefit analysis that's associated with it. Is the saved costs over time through healthier employees worth that increase, that natural increase you would see through that subsidization? And so it's a bit of it's a pilot. It's an experiment. It's something we have to manage and monitor quite closely. Too soon to tell.
Thank you. Please proceed.
If I could, I'm sorry, I can't resist. Just tell me to shut up if you want. But on the network, so the typical network proposition is that we go to a provider and we say, we will bring you our volume of patients. You provide the care at a discounted rate. And it's a win-win for the provider and for the plan. They get more patients. We get cheaper costs over time. In fact, the way this has been implemented elsewhere is that the co-insurance amount, you recall going back here, you see that 70, 80, 90 there. We would, if we had a good, healthy network with good discounts, we could potentially raise that co-insurance amount to 90% across the board if we got the providers to come back to us and give us pretty steep discounts. So they would win by having higher volume. We would win by having lower costs. The employee would win by having higher co-insurance amounts. That's what a network does. We don't have that in Alaska. That's called steerage, another jargon term. But what we're hunting for in a lot of our discussions is how can we implement effective steerage? Now, we're not talking about necessarily steering folks to out of state. We'd like to steer folks to providers in Alaska that can provide high quality care at a discount in exchange for volume. That's where we need to go.
Yep. Our office certainly dealt with someone who, you know, the preferred provider, i.e. a hospital, they felt with some justification that the treatment they was getting was unethical and substandard. They had no choice to go anywhere else unless they paid a lot out of pocket. And I don't know how to deal with that, but I think in the rare cases, it's probably true. Please continue.
And Mr. Chair, that's on the plan administrator. It's our responsibility to make sure that the care that's being provided and paid for is required, ethical, necessary. And if we're paying for care that's unnecessary, that's really on us.
Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Miller.
I probably won't ask this well, but as we're discussing this, I'm just thinking there's a lot of consumers of health care that are outside of the network. And I a comment on RFP or a question. Will it be considered whether or not the pricing will be transparent for all? Because we get this strange situation where if we provide the volume from the state for a particular service, then, you know, the small employer out there that has maybe one or two that is trying to pay cash and make it work, who's not part of that group, you know, pays a whole lot more. So the question that I'm basically asking is, how are you addressing the transparency?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think you've hit on something we're very concerned about and something that's very difficult. We want a functioning market. One of the hallmarks of a functioning market is that you know what something costs. And we don't know always what something costs when it comes to health care. And there are not many other services where we as a consumer would purchase a service without knowing what it costs up front and just rely that they're going to be fair and give us a bill on the end that's accurate. Now, that being said, we can't put all of the focus or the blame on the consumer because it's very difficult from a consumer standpoint to find out what something costs. So we believe that this is a very, you know, as you know, a very large issue that the Healthcare Commission is looking at and others around the state are looking at. But what can we do from our part? And I think what we can do from a state plan perspective is we can help our employees be better consumers. We can give them resources. We can walk them through what questions do you ask? And then we can insist that our third-party administrator be a good partner in helping them as well. That when our employees call the third-party administrator and want to know what their coverage is going to be, and that it's not just that the plan's going to pay at 80%, it's going to be, well, here's what you need to ask your doctor. Let's make sure that that provider is within our usual and customary charges. Let's make sure that you're not going to get an unexpected bill at the end of this procedure. So I think there are a lot of larger policy issues regarding transparency and pricing that could be considered at the state level. But from our plan perspective, we want to make sure that we're educating our employees to be better consumers, and that our third-party administrator is working to do their job in the best way that they can to help our employees as well.
Thank you. Yep. On that line, Representative Keller and I worked on what we called truth in billing. Is that what we called it here? And the providers immediately panicked and so on and so forth. But I was told by the largest provider in the state that they don't know the information we wanted on what individual things. And the really disgusting or difficult part was the cost shifting, you know, from the services that didn't pay for themselves to those that did. So we not only don't know what it really costs, but we don't know what part of our bill that we're paying, the state and I, is going to subsidize some other services within the hospital. And that's really irritating.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're seeing some positive signs regarding transparency and pricing outside the state, but I think it's starting to creep into the state. One solution is a bundled payment, where if you're buying a service, say you're going to buy a hip replacement, and I use buy because I'm talking about, you know, from the payer perspective, you have a patient that needs a hip replacement, you're going to pay for it. There are now many large large medical centers that will provide you a guaranteed bundled payment for that service. Bundled payment means it's the hospital charge, it's the anesthesiologist charge, and it's the surgeon's charge. Every charge wrapped into one payment. And you have certainty about what that payment's going to be because you know it up front. And so we're seeing that in other markets. It's not quite spread to the Alaska market, but I think it's coming. And as a plan, to Representative Keller's point, what we can do is we can be out there in the market saying to providers, bring us bundled payments, bring us innovation, because as a large purchaser of healthcare, we can help impact the market. Our goal is not to get the best deal for us and to have the small businesses pay more. Our goal is we need fundamental transformation of this market to make it a more functioning market, to make it a more transparent market. And I think we can help be a catalyst to do that, which then can improve the healthcare market for everyone. Now, we're relatively small plan, but I think actions of employers the size of ours, similar actions by multiple employers, can help have that impact on the market.
Why can't you just say to them, part of your bid or your proposal here has got to include giving us the information we want?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's in our RFP at the moment, but I think it's certainly something that should be a consideration down the line as we continue down this path.
Well, I don't mean to dominate this, but getting the information on the cross subsidy, you know, I think is what we, the customer, need to know. And I think it's disingenuous for them to both tell us that they don't have that information. And so I'm sorry, I'm preaching. Please continue.
I think I'll move to the next slide. We could probably go on for another hour on that slide. Let's talk about something else. Okay, so this slide comes from Kaiser Health in California, very large health consortium. They collect data from across the country. We've used some of their slides so far this morning. This is another one that just shows the relative participation of employees and employers in payment of health insurance premiums. So we've got four bars here. The first one is that relative participation in the private employment context, and you can see that the relative level of participation is roughly the same, but private employees tend to pay
$4,500 a year towards just over $15,000 in premiums. So it's, you know, somewhere in the range of 25 to 30%. Public employees tend to pay a little bit less, slightly higher premiums. My math, 20-some percent, maybe 25%. Nonprofit employees pay a little bit more, and then on an average basis, it, you know, employees across the country considered in the aggregate pay about $4,300 a year on total premiums of $15,700. If we were to put the economy plan on this chart, it would be all orange. The employer pays all of the premiums. Now, why are we saying this? It's just to say that the state of Alaska, for better or for worse, is outside the norm right now. And there's a policy discussion to be had with you folks, with our stakeholders, about whether we should start to go more into the norm and how that would take place. Now, that may immediately seem threatening to employees who are currently not paying anything for care. It's not intended to be. One of the themes that dominates our discussions is that of sustainability. We want to have sustainable health care for Alaska employees, for Alaska retirees, for private citizens in the state of Alaska. How do we get there? Right now, our view is that we are on an unsustainable path. At some point, something's going to break. There's going to be dislocation. Folks are going to fall out of care. Right now, we know that in school districts, there's a discussion going on. And it's no longer and, Mr. Chair, health insurance and maintaining teachers. It's becoming an or discussion, health insurance or keeping our teacher count. As we go, because of the huge increases in health care, we get into more of these or discussions. It puts at risk sustainability considerations. How do we address that? And we're putting this on the table for you to consider now. Join us in the discussion on how we get to a point of sustainability. Now, I'll also say that we believe that where there is more employee skin in the game, provider costs come down. When you start to pull back on those subsidies, the provider's costs come down. And that is additionally something that we think we need to address.
And Senator Wilkowski and then Senator or Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've seen numbers over the years that show the uninsured patients cost the state of Alaska over $100 million. The number that I last recall seeing, I think it was a couple of years ago, is that every employee essentially picks up another $2,000. $2,000 of this payment is because you're paying for those people who are not insured. Is that sort of your rough estimate? And that's probably gone up, I'm guessing, over in the last couple of years.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we all know that because we've made the decision, and rightly so in this country, that if you walk into an emergency room, you get health care, that certainly commercial payers are subsidizing to a great extent that care, and also the portion of costs that Medicare does not cover. So certainly the subsidization exists. What the magnitude is of it, I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, on your point of sustainability, Mike, this to me is you can't overstate that from my concern, from my personal perspective. And I just read recently something that said the IRS projected the cost per family in 2018 for health insurance coverage will be in the neighborhood of $20,000. Now, that's all I know, as a sentence like that. And I was wondering if maybe you could provide, I appreciate the approach you've taken in this presentation, and I agree with the approach you've taken in this presentation. You're looking at what exists and the rate of increase now, up till now, and it's alarming, and it's enough to make your sustainability appointment. But I think that if we take that IRS projection and be able to compare it, you know, with what we're contributing per employee in the state, what we would anticipate in 2018. I would sure appreciate it. And I know there's differences. I know it can't be a one-to-one, but, you know, roughly speaking, it looks like another 33% by 2018. And, you know, I mean, that's very, and that could be a very inaccurate because I don't have the information. So could you help us on that?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, if I'm understanding, you want us to project out what our premium costs might look like in 2018?
Yes, please.
And we can certainly do that according to maybe the past decade's trend. I would, I think, to your point, there we have a slide in a different presentation that talks about the fact that by 2037, health insurance premiums will swallow the average paycheck. So health insurance premiums will grow to be larger, or at least the same as the average annual paycheck. And we all just know that's just not sustainable.
We have about 5 minutes left, and Representative Lynn and I will
we've got
discuss whether or not to have another meeting. We've seen a very good presentation and a very impressive series of questions from people that are here that are both knowledgeable and concerned. You might want to, your choice, skip or go to slide 30 and to the end, which I think it talks about how you're going to approach getting from where we're at to where we should be.
Thank you, Mr.
Your
Chairman.
Call.
And I appreciate the engagement and the good questions, and we're happy to come back or to provide you with any other information that the committees or that your two committees would like. I'm going to note before I cover this slide and close that we're looking at two different models for changing, potentially changing our health plan into the future. And the first is a value-based health plan design that uses financial incentives to encourage healthy choices and discourage unhealthy choices. That's a little more paternalistic, dare I use that word, than we're necessarily used to in a government context or in an Alaska context. But nevertheless, the state of Nebraska has implemented this model and has had a great deal of success. We're also looking at whether in the future we should develop a consumer-directed health plan, which is a high deductible health plan married with a health savings account. The beauty of that plan is it gives employees skin in the game because the money that they're spending is from their own account. But nevertheless, it continues to protect them from those high cost events, and it provides them with money that they can use for their health care now and roll over to pay for future health care. So the state of Indiana has implemented this model and has seen significant savings. So both of these models have been implemented in states with a great deal of success. We may look at pulling the best of both approaches in the future because there are some things in the value-based design that you can implement in other health plans as well. So that being said, the next series of slides goes over the details of those two plans, and if you're interested in that, I think there's some good information there. So what are we doing to help contain our costs now within our current plan structure and then looking to the future? The first thing we're doing is implementing an employee wellness program. We felt like we needed to be more active and engaged in helping our employees to take better care of themselves. So components of that program have included the free preventive care, which we talked about earlier, and we're monitoring as a pilot program. We're also covering tobacco cessation 100% now, including pharmaceuticals for the first time. We're working to help to have our workplaces become more healthy as a culture. We have an employee wellness committee. We're encouraging different departments to do things like walk at work, to do monthly fitness challenges, and to do other things that help to develop that culture of health. And then we covered, as a pilot program, Weight Watchers at Work for employees. And we had some astounding success in 6 months. We had people that were reporting life-changing results, literally, in getting off medication, in becoming more active. We had one employee write in and say, you know, I can go out and play with my kids and not get winded. And it's those kinds of things that bring not just a near-term return on investment, but a long-term return on investment in terms of health costs and in terms of quality of life. We're going to continue to look at how we can broaden and expand our wellness program. We want to see improved consumerism and appropriate utilization of services by our members. It's important that our employees have skin in the game and that they help us by becoming educated consumers of healthcare. Because what we really need in order for our market to function well is alignment, financial alignment between the payer, that's us, the patient, and the provider. right now, those three are not in financial alignment. And when you have a situation where alignment is not there, where money appears after deductibles and copays are met free, then we get increasing costs of care. So we need to look at how do we align the interests of our of payers, patients, and providers. We're looking at contracting strategies, as we said. A great deal of savings comes from our provider network discounts, and so we're looking at how we can get the best network and then leverage the best prices for the state. And then we've gone over the procurement of the third-party administrator. That is just a huge effort in terms of staff time, and once we get a third-party administrator on board, whether it's our current one or a different one, and get through that process, we'll be much better able to take on some of these larger issues that we've talked about today. Really, the purpose today is to kind of give you an overview of what our plans look like, let you know what the kinds of things are that we're thinking about, and give you some time to maybe contemplate those yourselves and give us feedback, because we're at the beginning stages of looking at how we can could potentially change or improve our plans. And obviously, the legislature is a very important stakeholder group from a policy perspective and as consumers of this health plan, and we welcome your feedback. So what are the barriers to success?
I think we better quit.
Okay.
We're just about out of time. Thank you. It's been very valuable. And for all the committee members, if you have other questions, I think you have the Representative Lynn or myself, and we'll forward them and distribute the answers. We'll make a decision about whether or not to meet with you again. And I also wanted to acknowledge the help we've had from Heather Parker and Lori Rowland, who are managing all this, and thank you for your assistance.
I'd like to join Senator Dyson and thank you for your presentation. But before we adjourn, I have a presentation I need to make. Would Representative Price Tompkins please stand? This is his birthday today. Due to our complicated procurement process, the cake did not arrive, and the fire marshal didn't allow it to have candles. So I'd like to present you with these
24 donut balls.
24 donut balls. Happy birthday, Representative Price Tompkins.
We're adjourned.
Committee. We meet Tuesday. We will probably be considering HB 46 on drivers, commercial drivers' license skills, and maybe some more on the agenda. Thank you so much, everybody. We are adjourned.